Nederland podcast with David Amoyal.
Bienvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian, regardless of which language you're fluent in or not. We're thrilled that you're joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcio Land podcast. So today it's just Alex and I. We're going to talk a little bit about the World Cup, tidy up the Nainggolan to Inter transfer, name some winners and losers for the first month of the transfer window in Serie A, and answer your fantastic Twitter questions. So I'm joined by our great friend, producer, co-host Alex Goldberg. Today you put out a fantastic video on Batshuayi. Really enjoyed it. Your videos are going viral. So Alex, it's a pleasure to have you back on. I wanted to ask you, we had an intense weekend of World Cup games, some games this morning. We're recording this on Monday afternoon. So tell me a little bit, what stood out to you in the most recent games, Alex?
All right. Well, so there's so many different countries, so many different players at hand. So I could sit here and recap everything, or I could pick out a couple things that maybe I'm being biased, but maybe I just really want to point out. First of all, one of the best games, or at least best finishes over the weekend, was Germany-Sweden. And what that Toni Kroos goal did for me was solidify that I don't know who the best midfielder in the world is, but he's on Real Madrid, David. It's either Luka Modric, who had an unbelievable goal for Croatia, or it's either Toni Kroos. Those guys are such complete midfielders. There's no wonder that Real Madrid has won three straight Champions League titles. And then I want to talk about a country that is actually doing what they are supposed to do. And of course, they have my favorite player in world football, and that's Eden Hazard. But Belgium, I don't care if they've played Panama and Tunisia to way lesser sides. They're doing what they're supposed to do. They're playing attractive football. They're playing confident football. They looked like a lost team under their previous manager, Mark Wilmots, or Wilmots, however you pronounce it. But Roberto Martinez, I don't think he's a great manager, but he's doing what he's supposed to be doing with Belgium, and that's letting them play their style. And then on the contrary, David, I look at a team like France that has so much talent. I look at someone like Didier Deschamps, and I feel he's just confused how to use that talent. Sometimes these international squads, and I know Argentina's going through it, but many countries go through it, they're really hard to manage. Sometimes a manager might be overwhelmed by all of the international talent he has, and instead of picking all of the superstars, he elects to go with more of a team and exclude some of the superstars. But I feel in France's scenario, you play to your style. If you have talented players like Mbappe and Dembele, you play to your style. So there's a big contrast, I believe, in some of the top countries either admitting their style and playing to it, like a Belgium, and even like an England now being more cohesive with youth and exciting players. And then some countries that are just unsure how to use all their talent, like a France or an Argentina. So that's what's really stood out to me. But once again, I want to bring it back to Eden Hazard is solidifying himself as a top five. Yeah, I said it, a top five player in the world. And I've really been impressed in terms of how he's been a captain as well, really igniting Romelu Lukaku. So those are my takeaways, David. What about you?
Yeah, I agree a lot with what you said. I mean, the one thing that stood out to me is, you know, that match Japan-Senegal was really excellent. I'm more and more into the idea of even having more teams at the World Cup. I'm not so worried about the quality of it. Like, look, you know, you want fantastic quality and really see the best of the best going at each other. That's the Champions League. I think it's been vastly superior to the World Cup, especially this edition, where we're seeing a lot of set pieces really decide a lot of the matches. But when I look at, you know, the emotion, the great storylines with the countries that we don't normally associate with the World Cup, I'm really into it. I just see, you know, really the parallel to like the NBA being the Champions League and March Madness being the World Cup, just the way there's so many games and a lot of great storylines and underdogs. So I'm all in for that. I really wouldn't have said that a while back. Maybe it's easier for me now because both Italy and the U.S. are out of it, so I don't have a dog in the race, and I get a little more excited with, you know, some teams that I don't normally watch. The other thing that stood out to me, I really enjoyed watching Colombia. I mean, James, what a player when on the international level. Really terrific what he does for Colombia. That was a great match yesterday. And the last thing that really stood out to me is I really enjoyed during the Colombia match watching Rene Higuita, their former legendary goalkeeper, in the stands. It really reminded me of like how different the world is now with information, videos, and whatnot. I mean, I was growing up in Italy. I used to hear about Higuita. This was well before YouTube and all. And he was like a mythical figure. It was like a comic book character come to life. You know, we watched some grainy video highlights, and I kept hearing about this goalkeeper with long hair that could dribble and pass, like a great offensive player who could do the scorpion bicycle kick. I mean, this guy was just kind of legendary, and I just watched little videos of it, and then I finally saw him play in a match when Milan faced him in the Intercontinental Cup, and it was really like a comic book hero coming to life. So seeing him in the stands really reminded me of how different the world is now. Now, Alex, the other thing I wanted to ask you is I polled my Twitter followers this weekend. So Nainggolan Inter, we're recording this on Monday. They showed all the pictures of him meeting the fans and whatnot. This time he actually had the scarf and whatnot. So I wanted to ask you, we've seen a lot of pretty surprising moves in Serie A in the past 2 years. So I'm going to ask you which one you find to be the most surprising. So we have Nainggolan to Inter. We had Carlo Ancelotti to Napoli this summer. And last year we had Bernardeschi leaving Fiorentina to join bitter rival Juventus. And, of course, we had a Bonucci joining Milan. So if I had to ask you, which one was the most surprising and why?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, David. I have to. My gut, you always go with your gut. It's still Bonucci to Milan, and I say that more because of what Bonucci meant to Juventus. I never would have thought that if Bonucci were to leave Juve, it would ever be in Serie A. Of course, there were rumors for a while that maybe he'd go to Manchester City with Pep Guardiola, or perhaps even to Chelsea with Antonio Conte, but I never thought in my wildest dreams that Bonucci would go to another Serie A giant. So that takes the cake for me, but Nainggolan to Inter is definitely pretty surprising for me as well. That's probably second on my list, just because he obviously had a great season 2 years ago, and at that point everybody wanted to strike while the iron was hot in terms of acquiring him, but he said he was happy in Rome. And then all of a sudden I thought to myself, well, if he's going to go anywhere, he's clearly happy in Rome if he's going to stay in Italy. So if he's ever going to go anywhere, it's probably going to be outside of Serie A once, you know, he just has had enough with that. So seeing him go to Inter is definitely a little surprising, because if you had asked me 2 years ago, would he go to another Serie A club, I would say no chance. He absolutely loves it at Roma. And, you know, Ancelotti, definitely, that was not on my radar at all. I mean, you know, because I'm so focused selfishly on Maurizio Sarri and what's happening with Chelsea, I wasn't really even thinking about who would be Napoli's replacement. But Ancelotti, especially the fashion that they got him in so quickly, and all of a sudden Ancelotti's the manager while Sarri's still in the club, that was crazy surprising to me. But by far, the one that takes the cake for me is Bonucci to Milan as most surprising. What about you, David?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can make a great case for a lot of them. And I think, you know, it's easy to gravitate to Bonucci and Nainggolan, but then you get past the surface. You know, there was the family reasons why Bonucci wanted to stay in Serie A. We had seen the writing on the wall in a way, and maybe we didn't make enough of it when Allegri benched him for the Champions League match and whatnot. And we've seen Juve back Allegri over players. So that, you know, was shocking to see a player of his caliber leave Juve to, was in the Champions League to go for a club that wasn't in one. And granted, there was a lot of optimism surrounding the move at Milan. Nainggolan, I think, yeah, it's surprising he stayed in Serie A because he turned down a lot of offers from the Premier League in China before. But the fact that Spalletti was there shouldn't be making it too surprising. And the other thing, too, I've been saying for years, I think people really underestimate Inter on the transfer market. Granted, this is the first year where they finally got back to the Champions League, where it translated to results on the pitch. But Inter on the transfer market have been really, really good for a while. Ancelotti to Napoli, I think that was rather shocking. That really came out of nowhere in a lot of ways. I think it's even interesting that Di Marzio himself, there was a lot of other sites that were reporting on this, he dismissed it, and when the move finally happened, he even gave kudos to a lot of the people in Naples that were reporting about this up front, and he goes, listen, I didn't believe it. So I almost could make a case that's the one. But I think the one that people are really sleeping on, and on the poll it didn't surprise me that it was dead last, is Bernardeschi to Juve. I was shocked that Fiorentina would change their policy. In previous years, if you followed the transfers, Juve was interested in Jovetic. They really would have loved to sign him the summer that they brought in Tevez. Fiorentina refused to even open negotiation with them, although Jovetic was interested in joining them. When Cuadrado was on Fiorentina, it was a player that Conte really, really wanted desperately at Juve, and that didn't happen. So, I'm a believer that until the status quo changes, I'm going to go on the assumption that things remain the same. So last summer, that's one of the things that I looked the most bad on, is I never felt Fiorentina was going to sell him to Juve, but great work by the intermediary in the deal. Lawyer Bozzo got that done. So I really feel like now in Serie A especially, we really live in the twilight zone where a lot of things, when we think of like, could this deal happen, a lot of the factors that normally we would think would disqualify a move from happening aren't that important anymore. So in a way, it makes it even more exciting. Really, as Kevin Garnett said after he won the title with the Celtics, anything is possible.
I like that. Good reference right there. That one's still played on ESPN like every other day. So, David, let's go to a segment that we are not doing as much since there's no season going on, but there's always winners and losers, right? So, without further ado, who are winners and losers of episode 127 of the Calcioland podcast?
So I want to recap a little bit. It's hard to believe, but we're already basically a month is down in the transfer window this year because the window closes in mid-August. It's going to actually go by pretty fast. So I think it's important to kind of take stock of as what's happened so far. But I think the first winner is going to surprise a lot of people. I have Milan as a winner. And I know as we're recording this, we're waiting to find out what UEFA is going to rule regarding their participation in the Europa League. There's a lot of speculation as to why UEFA is delaying issuing the ruling. The more positive people are saying that UEFA might be waiting to see what happens with the ownership situation to see if it will be resolved. The more pessimistic people are reporting that UEFA is taking their time because they really want to write the ruling in a very precise and clear way. That way it won't be overturned when it goes to the TAS, which is the last court that can review this. But the way I see it, regardless of what happens, it's really important for Milan to clarify their ownership situation once and for all. To me, in a way, it's like, when someone that has problems, the only way they can really turn it around is when they really hit rock bottom. And there's a saying in Italy that I think really explains the situation really well. And the saying is tutti i nodi vengono al pettine, which means, when you're brushing your hair, sooner or later, all the knots in your hair are going to get to the comb. And I think, we talked about it on the podcast when we had Tariq Panja from the New York Times. The oversight that happened in Italy over the Milan sale was poor, to say the least. It really didn't seem that there was enough due diligence. And UEFA, look, I get a lot of Milan fans are really angry and making comparisons to PSG and whatnot, but I really think it's important that UEFA makes sure that this type of sale like Milan went through doesn't happen again. I think the fact that the Chinese owners had to borrow the money from Elliott at the last second with a huge interest rate, I mean, that really says it all. So the way I see it, if you want to blame someone, I really wouldn't blame UEFA. I go back, and I've been saying this for the longest time, you should blame Berlusconi because he always said he was going to sell Milan to someone that could make the club great again. That was clearly not the case here. And I think because now we finally have an institution that is doing oversight on Milan, and granted, it might be very tough, but they are doing oversight. It's going to translate likely into Milan ending up in the hands of owners that can actually afford it. So I definitely have a lot of sympathy for Milan fans. I know this is a really rough period. This time last year, it seemed like the banter era was over, but I think something really good could come out of it. And look at it this way. Look at Juve after Calciopoli. They were out of European competitions for two seasons because they were relegated to the second division. That was their rock bottom moment. And look at how strong Juve is now. They are a force not just in Italy, in all of Europe. So look, it might suck in the short term, but if you have the right people running the club, Milan's going to be much better off. The status quo with these Chinese owners simply cannot stand. So I'm going to say it might seem really odd, but I think Milan are big winners now. It might suck in the short term, but I really think we're going in the right place. So hopefully soon on Milan, we'll be talking about transfers, what happens on the pitch, and not the ownership situation. As far as teams that are doing really well on the transfer market, I mean, we have to start with Inter. They've really had on paper what looks like an amazing transfer window. So we have De Vrij, who arrived from Lazio. We have Asamoah from Juventus. We have now Nainggolan arriving from Roma. So these are all key, important players. Asamoah, maybe not a key player, but still an important contributor on teams that are competing with Inter for a Champions League spot. All these address a need. They also brought in Lautaro Martinez. The other thing you got to give credit to Inter, they had to raise funds for financial fair play. They were able to do it without selling any significant player. They made a lot of plusvalenza on youth team players. So, you know, except for Cancelo, not being able to keep Cancelo, and he's pretty much going to Juve, you know, you really couldn't have had a better start to the transfer window with Inter. But again, you know, decide del campo, it's the pitch that decides. We saw it last summer with Milan. But when I look at the moves that Inter made and players that are Serie A proven, it's really hard to nitpick what they're doing. I think Juve are winners as well. They went into the summer with some clear needs. They needed to improve at the wing-back position. João Cancelo's all but done, should be taking the medical on Wednesday. I thought João Cancelo was excellent pushing forward for Inter. I think with Allegri, he could get a lot better defensively. We knew Juve had to improve their midfield. Emre Can was finally made official. The players they brought in from Atalanta, Caldara could be a very important player at center back for them as they try to get younger there. And Spinazzola, who is hurt, eventually when he comes back, will address a need as well. And they also got Pirin. Important to note, they also kept him away from Roma and Napoli. So I think overall, Juve's got to be pretty happy with the start to the transfer window. Other winner is Bologna. I've been pretty impressed with their transfer moves so far. I brought in an outstanding keeper from Roma, Skorupski, who was really good when he started for Empoli. I've heard good things of the striker they brought in from Copenhagen, Santander. I think, you know, the jury's still out on how good a coach Pippo Inzaghi is going to be, but at least he paid his dues, did very well at Venezia, now is ready to be in Serie A. I think Donadoni is a good manager, but I think he really had stayed at Bologna too long. Other winners, I'd say Serie A as a whole, the three newly promoted teams should be competitive. We, of course, have Parma. We had Frosinone, who was in Serie A the year before. And then we have Empoli, a team that has traditionally done pretty well in Serie A. And the last winner, I'm going to say Sassuolo. I was very happy that they hired De Zerbi, the manager who did quite well at Benevento, although they were relegated, a team that played really well and hard. Offensive style could really be follow Di Francesco's career path. Losers, now these could really change because especially the first two are clubs that I have a lot of faith in on the transfer market. But when you look at Atalanta, they've lost three significant starters in Caldara, Spinazzola, and Cristante. Granted, they are great at transfers. I'm sure some of the young players, Tuminello, who came from Roma, is a very intriguing young player. They know what they're doing, but look, on paper, they have lost some significant players. Same with Lazio. De Vrij was a big loss for sure, especially seeing him go to Inter. Lazio had tried to keep him. There's some delays with Felipe Anderson potentially going to West Ham, but if he doesn't go to West Ham, which I still think is more likely than not, he'll probably be on the way out. But just like Atalanta, Lazio does have a good track record of replacing players. And then these aren't really losers, but when I look at how much Inter has improved, I think Napoli and Roma have to be a little bit concerned. I think Napoli, Ancelotti was a great move. Verdi was a really good move. But let's see what happens. I think there is some potential for some significant players leaving, especially you know, with whatever happens with Sarri, and they're still frantically looking to get a goalkeeper. It looks like it will be Mere from Udinese, who was at loan on Spal, but he's a very young keeper. He goes into a big pressure situation. I'm not surprised that they're trying to bring in Consigli from Sassuolo to kind of be an insurance policy on him. at Roma. I think this is more of like a perception. I think the Nainggolan deal isn't as bad as people are making it out to be, but they are losing their most significant player since Francesco Totti. So let's see what happens with Roma. You know, I think they're gambling a lot on the young players that they brought in, Kluivert, Kostic. Let's see what they can do. And I think Cristante, there is the potential that he's Gasperini fool's gold, and then we need to see what happens with Alisson. So those are our winners and losers so far and for the transfer window. Now let's get into the fantastic Twitter questions. As a reminder, we love getting questions on Serie A, transfers for all leagues, journalism, TV, music, films, you name it. So send them in with the Calcioland hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start off with this one. What do you make of Rocco Commisso being linked to Milan? And do you think he would be a better fit than the Ricketts family?
It's a good question. And look, you know, I'm going to be very honest. I don't know that much about Commisso. I've been mainly reading about him in Gazzetta dello Sport. He seems to have a very good rapport with that paper because they've put a lot of information on him. So he's an entrepreneur that works on cable television in U.S., has done really well. He's the owner of the New York Cosmos, a team in the NASA League here in the U.S. Definitely has a passion for Serie A. He grew up in Calabria, then moved to the U.S. So I don't know too much about him beyond that. I think the Ricketts family, we do have more of a track record of them owning a major franchise. Like the difference between the Chicago Cubs and the New York Cosmos is massive. I don't think we can even compare the two. So I don't know enough about Mr. Commisso to really compare him to the Ricketts, but just based on the information that I that we all have, it seems the Ricketts might be more of a sure thing. Now, what's interesting about this situation is, not surprisingly, both Mr. Commisso and the Ricketts family just want to buy Milan outright. I don't know how anyone in their right mind would want to be a minority owner to these Chinese owners, especially someone that actually has money, unless you think you'll get your foot in the door and then eventually sell the club. So it's going to be interesting to see how this negotiation is going to happen. Is the Elliott Fund going to wait to take over and then sell the club, or are these entities going to try to negotiate with Yong Li and the Elliott Fund? So interesting situation. I do think at the end of the day, though, we will see Milan with new owners, and I think the club's just going to be so much better for it.
All right, how about this? Is it fair to say Inter's moves on the transfer market are reminiscent of the way Juventus has operated in recent years?
It's a very good point. And the listener pointed out that, you know, Inter has gone for free transfers. They've targeted players on other Serie A teams, so potentially weakening opponents. So I see the parallels, and I'm going to take it a step further. What we saw Inter in the past few years is very reminiscent of the way Juve did transfers in the first few years of the Marotta regime, and still even now, those loans with option to buy deals, which basically spread out the payments over multiple years, make it much more attractive with how you register the transfer fees and the club's balance sheet. So there's definitely a lot of parallels. Another one that I'll throw out there is they're bringing in players that Spalletti, their manager, really wants, that fits his system. In a way, this is reminiscent of when Conte was there, who really insisted on bringing players that would fit what he was looking to do. Can make a great case. Nainggolan could be the version of Inter of what we saw with Vidal in his prime. So it's a very good observation from our listener. I definitely see parallels to the two clubs. And if you're an Inter fan, you got to feel great about the direction of the club so far.
Definitely. I think they've done brilliant so far this window. David, next Twitter question. Are Juve interested in Anthony Martial, and could he be a factor in a potential Alexandro deal?
Yeah, I mean, Martial checks all the boxes for the types of players that Juve does look for. Like, you know, he's disgruntled, looking for, you know, a clean slate, a fresh start. They could certainly offer it to him. I think his contract expires in 2019, so they're planning the seed if, God forbid, he becomes available on a free transfer, trying to find the bargain. Now, if Manchester United's really trying to get $80 million or a huge fee for Martial, I think that would disqualify Juve, unless it was somehow on a loan with forced option to buy deal. But I think Juve, on the right circumstances, would really like to have him. Now, the other thing, though, is you have to look. Juve is really deep at his position. They have Dybala, Bernardeschi, Cuadrado, they have Piaka coming back, they have Mandzukic that they use as a winger. But I was thinking, if Juve actually does sell Higuain, it wouldn't be the worst idea in the world to move Dybala back to central striker. That's the position where he was at Palermo, where he was devastating. I know with the body type Dybala has, it's hard to kind of look at him as a classic number nine, but he can play in that role, and maybe Martial could play on the wing. Imagine an attack of him, Dybala, and Douglas Costa with Bernardeschi and Cuadrado off the bench. That would be really exciting. But I think, you know, at the prices Manchester United are rightfully asking right now for Di Martial, for Martial, it's not that easy. Now, as far as Alexandro, you know, when people were saying, oh, is Darmian a factor in Alexandro, to me that would be like saying, you know, Juve should offer Sturaro to try to get Martial. Like, to me, there's really no connection between the two other than the fact that, you know, they play for the clubs interested in the deal. But, you know, Martial and Alexandro are closer in value on the transfer market. It would never work as a swap deal just because of how clubs record those transactions on their books, but maybe that could be separate deals. So I think this is a little bit more likely than saying that Darmian's a factor in Alexandro. So let's see how this situation evolves. It does sound like Martial is definitely on his way out of Manchester United.
Whoever does get Martial, they're getting at least a good risk, a 22-year-old who still has loads of talent, who really was not used correctly at Manchester United. That would be a great get for Juve if they got him. All right, David, this next Twitter question, this is a player I want on Chelsea, selfishly. Any chance Juventus sign Mateo Kovacic, especially after he stated he wants to get more playing time?
Look, Juve has liked Kovacic even when he was at Inter, and that was really when there was tension between the clubs after the Guarin-Vucinic fiasco. Juve was all about Kovacic, and when Pogba was sold, they were looking at him. And look, Juve has great relations with Real Madrid, but the fact is Real Madrid is going to ask for an arm and a leg for Kovacic. I'm not sure if Juve could afford him unless they were to sell Pjanic, and there's been some buzz on this, him potentially joining Barcelona. I know some people linked him to Chelsea. Barcelona makes quite a bit of sense to me, but, you know, we know with Juve, they'll only let Pjanic leave if he pushes to move, and they'll ask for a huge return. I think if that happens, when I look to at Pjanic and Kovacic, they do have some similarities. So this is, my gut tells me that he'd become a possibility with Juve only if Pjanic goes. But at this moment, Juve would definitely like to keep Pjanic, and he hasn't asked to leave quite yet. So let's see how this evolves.
All right, David, how about this? When a player like Perrin is purchased for $12 million, are there hidden fees like with Emre Can, or does the $12 million include everything?
Very good question. So I think everyone after that that press release that Juve issued on Emre Can saying, yeah, we have to pay $16 million over 2 years to get this transfer done, people are wondering, you know, are there more of these hidden fees? Like, you know, I think fans, for the most part, when they look at a transfer, they just look at the transfer fee. But a lot of times there are other costs. And I would always caution fans when trying to look at how much a club spent on transfers to always include the gross wages as well. I think, you know, looking at net sales for clubs to decide how much they've actually spent isn't by any means the best way to measure the actual expenditures. But in the case of Pirin, there could be some extra costs there, but definitely not as significant as the Emre Can deal. So a player with an expiring contract, there's usually very high agent fees, inflated wages as well. That's not the case when a player is on the contract. So really look at it this way. A player's contract, the length of the contract really decides who has leverage. The longer a player is under contract, the more his club has leverage on him. The lesser time on his contract, the less leverage the club has. And once the contract expires, then the agents are like, well, someone's going to get paid for this transfer, and if it ain't the club, it's going to be me. So with Pirin, as far, there might be some hidden costs, but definitely nothing remotely similar to Emre Can. Juve, because they're a publicly traded company, would have to report any significant expenditure. But as we've talked about on the podcast, because Perin was so cheap, relatively speaking, odds are there will certainly be more deals between Genoa and Juve before the transfer window ends. So when you look at clubs making multiple deals within the same year, usually within the same fiscal year, you really shouldn't look at them in a vacuum. You should kind of look at them all together, because it really has to do with how clubs report these deals on their books. And doing them as separate deals has a lot of advantages.
All right, next Twitter question, David. Is Ribalta the reason Juve and Manchester United's targets tend to be similar?
So for those that don't know, Ribalta was the former Juve scout, worked for them for a few years, that went to Manchester United, I think, last summer. And look, you know, maybe there are some parallels to the fact that maybe they look some of the same players, but I have a feeling this has a lot more to do with Mino Raiola than it does with Ribalta. And I'll explain it this way. Like, most clubs, you know, work with an agent or two closely on a lot of transfer deals. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that that agent represents the players that they want. Like, they usually act as intermediaries in deals, especially if a club is buying a player in a country, in, you know, not their own country, so looking abroad. Raiola has a lot of connections in a lot of countries, so I have a feeling this had more to do with the fact that both Manchester United and Juve work closely with Raiola. Ribalta, though, has done a good job at Juve. I'm sure he's doing a great job at Manchester United, but I think maybe a little bit overrated how much he had to do with a lot of Juve's moves, because their sporting director, Paratici, is their head scout. Marotta's really the finance guy, and Paratici's really the football scouting guy. So again, I would say probably more Raiola than Ribalta, but it is an interesting point. Maybe there is some overlap because of him.
All right, David, how about this? Let's stay on Manchester United. Could Manchester United sign one of Milan Skriniar or Koulibaly?
It's a good question. Both really, really outstanding. I think Koulibaly is the best center back in Serie A. Actually, I have no doubt that he is, but that's just my opinion. I think Skriniar, absolutely brilliant first season at Inter. But I think both of them, their current clubs would really love to keep him. Ancelotti, when he arrived, listed Koulibaly as one of the players that he absolutely didn't want to lose. I'd have a hard time seeing De Laurentiis upsetting his new manager by letting him go, especially after cashing in on Jorginho to Manchester City, which is all but done. Skriniar, to his credit, has really constantly said how much he loves Inter and how much he wants to stay there. There's talk that he's going to get an extension with a higher salary. So as of now, two Spalletti Inter's coaches saying that they're going to go with three center backs to get the most out of Miranda, De Vrij, and Skriniar. And man, what a trio. That's really badass there. So at this time, I would say that's pretty hard, but I'll give you a Serie A center back that I could see in the Premier League, maybe at Manchester United, at Chelsea, or another team, and that's Manolas on Roma. He does have an exit clause. I think it's 37 million euro. I think that's a very fair price for a center back of his quality. So I'm going to give you that name, since Skriniar and Koulibaly seem a bit unlikely to me.
All right, fair enough. Next Twitter question, David, and this player has underwhelmed me at the World Cup. Does Zielinski have a release clause in his contract?
Yeah, I think everyone on Poland's been really disappointing. And the world of comparison to De Bruyne probably went to Zielinski head. So he does have an exit clause for around 60 million, but, and a big but here, Zielinski with Koulibaly and Insigne were three other players that Ancelotti said, I really, really want these guys. I actually wonder, you know, if Napoli would have had a better chance at the Scudetto if Zielinski played more over Hamsik. So Napoli is working on giving him a new contract and getting rid of the exit clause. So I guess until that happens, a club could be willing to pay that, and Zielinski would have to agree to the move. But my guess is he's going to stay at Napoli again. Napoli cashed in on Jorginho. I think Zielinski could really be their main guy in the midfield next season. So, Alex, I have a question for you. One of our listeners asked us if you think that Barkley has a long-term future at Chelsea and how he would fit in on the team moving forward.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Honestly, I forget that Ross Barkley is even on Chelsea at times because it was such a weird way that he was acquired. Of course, he was acquired back in the January window, but he almost was acquired by Chelsea back in the summer before he nixed the deal because of not being fit. Ross Barkley has loads of potential, but at this point, he's just potential. Yes, he did play well for Everton once upon a time, but he is so injury prone. He's so hard to depend on. And there just are so many guys that you could say, well, if this, this, and this happens, he could be really good. And unfortunately, Ross Barkley falls right in that category. I do think he'd probably be pretty good under Maurizio Sarri, but no way do I want Sarri to hold up for Ross Barkley, give him all the time in the world to prove himself, because I want Chelsea to improve. So if Ross Barkley is not ready for preseason and not ready to impress someone like Maurizio Sarri, I'm not at all holding my breath for Ross Barkley. Talented player who I actually think could do really well in the triangular passing that Maurizio Sarri loves, but I don't pencil him in as a starter, and I really have a hard time even thinking that he's going to be favored over people like Bakayoko and even Cesc Fabregas, even though I honestly think Barkley probably has more to offer in a Sarri system. I just don't think Barkley is at all at the top of Chelsea's priorities, even if, and it's still an if, even if Maurizio Sarri does come to Stamford Bridge. So I would not hold my breath for Barkley to make an impact for Chelsea. There's an outside chance, but I would just put it at maybe 20%. So David, let's move on. Let's move away from football. What is your opinion of the Netflix series, The Staircase? And do you think Michael Peterson killed his wife?
So I really love documentaries on crimes and trials. Like, I'm in. I don't know what it is about courtroom, real life things that I become really fascinated. So The Staircase is a series that was on Netflix. It just got put on recently. It was a series, I had seen parts of it years ago. It's a French director followed this trial in North Carolina a while back, and they updated it with what happened on the appeal and more recently. So really fascinating case. For those that didn't watch it, very simply, this fairly famous author, Michael Peterson, was living in Carolina with his wife in a nice mansion. They were having dinner. They had drinks. He went by the pool. His wife went inside and supposedly fell down a staircase and died, and he found her there. And, you know, in the trial, he was accused of that she actually hadn't fell down the stairs, that he had beaten her to death. So it was a fascinating trial for a lot of reasons. I don't want to spoil it too much. If you're interested, definitely watch it. I think you'll enjoy it. It's really more about the justice system in the U.S. What was really interesting to me is someone like Michael Peterson, who definitely had a lot of resources and a lot of money. You'd think, you know, in the U.S. usually with that, you're going to be in great shape. But no, there's really a lot of things that happen in the justice system. So without spoiling it, I never felt he did the murder at all. There was probably no time during the trial that I thought he did. If you watch, there are some circumstances that are pretty bizarre, but I think those are pure crazy coincidences. So definitely interesting. I thought the lawyer for Michael Peterson was really, really excellent. I had watched him years ago during the Ray Carruth trial, a former NFL player who had got his wife killed and he represented her. And I thought he was kind of a scumbag because that NFL player was clearly guilty. He's actually getting out of jail now. I think he served 17 years, but definitely interesting. I also found Michael Peterson a fascinating character in and of himself, incredibly stoic guy. Yeah, like I really put up with a lot and really kept a stoic persona. So definitely recommend it. It might be a little bit too long. I think it could be maybe an episode or two shorter, but I think you'll really enjoy it if you're into the courtroom dramas and whatnot.
All right, David, last Twitter question. How would you describe U2's current arena tour?
So Friday, I went, we did the show with my friend Rob from Juve FC. If you're a Juve fan, that was definitely a lot of fun. We took a deep dive, and I was really excited the whole day because I had the U2 concert at the TD Garden here in Boston. I actually hadn't seen U2 live in like 17 years. I'm like ashamed to admit. I had seen him in Boston. They did a DVD of it live in Boston back in 2001. I hadn't seen him in person since then. It was really awesome, and it was awesome even though they didn't play any of the Joshua Tree, which has been kind of, in a lot of ways, the backbone of a lot of their tours. You knew you were going to get at least two, three, maybe four songs off the Joshua Tree at every U2 show. Didn't do any of that because they toured playing that whole album the year before. So that was a bold decision. Played a ton of new material. I'm fairly familiar with it, but it's not that like I'm crazy for their new material. But it was flat out awesome. Visually, as good an arena show as I've been to. The stage was really pretty insane. They played in every part of the arena. I really enjoyed it. Without getting too political, I think you can imagine that it was right in my wheelhouse, the message of the show. The highlight for me, I've never been a Bono type of guy. I've always loved U2 because of The Edge and despite Bono, but I thought he was really excellent. Now, I think he was singing in playback for most of that concert because he sounded really good and his voice is kind of shot, but I thought he was really, really great on the social commentary on what's going on in the world and in this country specifically. So without getting too political, I will just say that one phrase that he said really stayed with me. He says, you know, the idea of America is really beautiful. It's the type of dream that you have while you aren't sleeping. And there's never been a more important time to be awake to defend that dream. So I'm going to leave it at that for the political side of it, but I thought, without being too preachy, and made a lot of good points. And I want to close with one more pop culture note. I want to dedicate this episode of the Culture Land podcast to former Pantera drummer Vinnie Paul. I woke up on Saturday to see all these tweets on Vinnie Paul, and then I saw that he passed away. He was in his mid-50s. Came a little bit out of the blue. Now, Pantera hasn't been a band for like 15 years because their guitar player and Vinny's brother, Dimebag, was killed on stage when he was playing with another band. Pantera had already broken up, but there was always hope that they would get back together. But it was still shocking. Pantera, to me, is truly the last great metal band. Sure, there's Lamb of God, there's Mastodon, there's other bands, but I think Pantera was really outstanding. I'll never forget seeing the video for Walk for the first time. Vulgar Display of Power is one of the best metal albums I've ever heard. My first experience with Pantera, when I was very young, I went to this Monsters of Rock show in Modena in Italy. I went to see Iron Maiden, Megadeth, bands that I really liked, and Pantera were one of the first bands on stage. They played a half an hour, and they were absolutely awesome. Since then, I've been a huge fan. So rest in peace, Vinnie Paul. Thanks for the fantastic memories with Pantera. So I want to thank all our listeners. Please keep sending in questions for the upcoming podcast. Please use the CultureLand hashtag, and we'll be happy to answer your questions on the podcast. I really appreciate the reviews. If you're listening to us on iTunes, it will take literally 3 seconds for you to leave us a 5-star rating. You want to leave a comment, we read them all. It's easier for us to see the comments in the U.S. We already have 230 reviews right now, which is fantastic. I can't begin to tell you how much that helps the podcast grow. For those abroad, Alex sends me once in a while all the reviews. They're fantastic. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Please keep downloading our podcast. If you subscribe and download, it really helps us grow. So thank you so much for your support, and we look forward to bringing you two more episodes before the weekends.